Well, it's a big week for central banks, with the Fed, the Bank of England, the Bank of Japan and the SARB announcing their respective policy decisions. Ahead of that SARB meeting, we decided we'd take a leaf out of English band The Vapors song Turning Japanese, released in 1980, as the country has recently hosted a successful election. Japanese Chief Cabinet Secretary Yoshihide Suga won a landslide victory in a ruling party leadership election, paving the way for Japan's first change of leader in nearly 8 years. And when Shinzo Abe unexpectedly resigned as Japanese Prime Minister for health reasons, I think few South Africans would have batted an eyelid. But in the investment world, he's better known for Abenomics, the three-pronged plan of action that he announced in 2013 to lift Japan out of a long-term economic slumber, the lost decades. A frequent topic of discussion in markets is whether we're witnessing the steady Japanification of much of the developed world, and this will have profound implications for growth, for inflation, for monetary policy, as well as financial markets in the years ahead. Of course, here in South Africa, our worry is more stagflation, but we're joined now by Old Mutual Wealth Investment Strategist Dave Moore, Dr. Adrian Saville, Professor of Economics, Finance and Strategy at Gibbs, and Lumkile Mondi, a Senior Lecturer at the School of Economics and Business Sciences at WITS. Dave, now you released a note recently looking at this topic of Japanification for the developed world, and I think it means slightly different things to different people. What does Japanification mean for you?
Well, I think the first thing that comes to is basically deflation, or zero inflation, so very low inflation coupled with very low interest rates that don't seem to have any impact on the inflation. Then secondly, quantitative easing, what Japan has done over the years, the other countries dwarf into insignificance if you look at what the Japanese Central Bank has done. And that's combined, as I said, ultimately with extremely low growth. So if you look at nominal growth in Japan over a question of 20 years, it's basically been zero. If you look at wages, it's been basically zero over 20 years. If you look at inflation, CPI inflation, you take out the introduction of their sales tax, which they've gradually introduced from 1995 onwards, you find, in fact, that consumer prices today are slightly lower than 20 years odd ago. So that's sort of in a nutshell what I see as Japanification.
It doesn't sound too bad, though. If your wages are stagnating, but you've got slight deflation, you're paying less and less every year for those goods and services at a sort of constant wage, I suppose you might not be complaining. Let's talk, Adrian, about Abenomics, though, as we've just seen the resignation of Shinzo Abe on the back of health concerns. What was Abenomics really trying to do as this three-pronged policy to get Japan out of this secular stagnation that it found itself trapped in?
Well, you know, Japan had achieved a level of domestic prosperity, which you can measure by longevity, income per person, or high longevity, high incomes per person, very low unemployment rates. And it achieved that through an extraordinary industrialization over the 1950s, 60s, 70s, and into the 80s. And, you know, you're becoming Japanese. If you take your mind back to the late 1980s, early 1990s, the case studies, the iconic case studies of business school classrooms were not Apple or Google or Tencent. They were rather Sony and Honda and Yamaha. And that, I think, captures the extraordinary competitiveness and prosperity of Japan in the 1990s. But then the country went into a stall. And that stalled circumstance had trapped them for the better part of 20 years. And Dave made reference to that with, you know, frozen per capita incomes, an aging population. And the idea behind Abenomics was that through this three-pronged approach, the three arrows, it would strengthen competition, bolster growth, there would be regulatory reform taking the shape, amongst other things, of tax cuts. Perversely, at the same time, they were raising VAT, but corporate tax cuts, increased participation in the workforce by women, and for a country, for an economy that historically has been very closed to foreign workers, opening up the economy to foreign workers and foreign skills, and then forging strategic trade relationships and economic partnerships. And I think that captures sort of the broad thrust of Abenomics, and the success would be measured by improvements in GDP, the emergence of inflation, because it's very difficult to keep an economy ticking along when prices are falling, and then to do that without compromising unemployment, and all at the same time to do it whilst fixing a government balance sheet that had become very stretched and was running unsustainable deficits. I think that captures sort of the nub of Abenomics.
And Lumkile, to bring you in here, if you look at the causes of this, I mean, to go back to what Adrian referenced earlier, Japan was the emerging poster child in the early 80s. And you often hear from the government's perspective, the Japanese Ministry of Trade and Industry, the METI, as an example of good state-led growth. What caused this trap of secular stagnation following such a successful period of the 60s, 70s, and 80s?
I think we saw the lack of imagination through state intervention of METI, of really expanding faster into services. Although Sony, as indicated earlier by Professor Saville, that did expand across the globe, buying a lot of assets in America and elsewhere in the world. However, I think the fact that as cost rose in the industrialization process, they were not quick enough to decentralize and ensure that the wage structure, which was increasing rapidly as Japan was industrializing, was diffused into the other tigers at a much faster pace. So that diffusion, or the geese, as some scholars call it, took longer than expected. As a result, Japan went into that deflation, stagflation environment, whereby growth went down, deficits increased, as well as price started falling. So that, for me, what Abe inherited, and the reforms that he instituted that both Dave and Adrian have talked about, led to a huge recovery in Japanese economy. And I'm hoping that the successor will continue the reforms, open up the Japanese to more workers coming in, given the aging of Japanese, and really the partnerships that Adrian has talked to, South Africa and the rest of the continent, exploiting it in this African Continental Free Trade Agreement that we are now missing in the continent.
Yoshihide Suga certainly has been welcomed as a very pro-market leader of Japan, so those hopes are not without foundation. Dave, to come back to the issues here for monetary policy in the developed world, and particularly the Bank of Japan, because of inflation being entrenched at extremely low levels, these low levels of productivity growth, you've seen the super loose monetary policy from the Bank of Japan. And I suppose one important consequence of this is that the BOJ now has very little ammunition with which to fight a potential downturn.
Absolutely. I think this is something that they've been stuck with for the better part of the last 20 years. If you look at their whole program of quantitative easing, trying to keep their markets afloat. I mean, we've had the funny situation that typically we think long-term equities do better than bonds. In Japan, over the last 25 years, you know, there was no comparison. Bonds way outperformed equities, and on most measures, equity prices are even lower today than what it was then. So yes, their monetary policy, I think, has been trying to cope with two things. The one is that if you look at, and I think to my mind, that's a very important thing, what caused this whole implosion of Japan was the fact that if you go back to the early 90s, in fact, their private sector debt as a percentage of GDP was close on 300%. Now, I mean, we talk about debt explosions in countries. That was, you know, 30 years ago. They already had debt like that. And if you look at the massive deleveraging that took place in the private sector in Japan over the next 30 years.
That was the one challenge for monetary policy, was just to basically keep the economy going. And that's why they've had quantitative easing for years. And the second challenge was to try and get inflation up so that you develop some inflationary expectations. Because you basically have had a generation of Japanese growing up that have never seen inflation before. So you've got, that they struggle with very low inflation expectations, plus the fact that if you look at this long-term deleveraging of the private sector, those were the two major challenges. And if we look at what they've succeeded in, you know, they haven't been very successful in terms of inflation. And if you look at economic growth, there's some signs of that starting to improve now after a very, very long period. The other thing that, that monetary policy had to cope with was an unbelievably strong yen over that period, which obviously reinforced the whole Japanification process of low inflation, low growth, and also making it very difficult for those export companies that Lily was talking about to compete globally.
Absolutely, and while we saw them lose out to those peripheral Asian countries in terms of their export competitiveness, Adrian, what does this mean for the Japanification of the rest of the world? Because there's a conversation that we're now happening because because we haven't seen inflation in the world for some time now. There were big concerns following the very loose monetary policy experiments of the post-global financial crisis era that all of this money printing would eventually result in runaway inflation. And it hasn't happened in Europe, it hasn't happened in the US, and I suppose the fear is that the world, the developed world, is now entering into a period of its own Japanification. How valid is that concern?
I think that's multifaceted. And it's an extraordinarily complex question. The complication comes from the being Japanese aspect. There's a lovely quote that Simon Kuznets, the economist, Nobel Prize economist, and he says that there are four types of economies: developed economies, developing economies, Argentina, and Japan. the sort of the joke amongst economists is that Japan, because it's an enigma, it's a mystery, it's wrapped inside of its own curiosities and complexities, and here you've got an economy that has achieved driven to a government debt to GDP level of more than 200%, which in a textbook economics says, well, at that point, you should default on your debt and you should be kicked out of all loan agreements. They've been furiously printing money. They got to what was called ZIRP, zero interest rate policy, and now NERP, negative interest rate policy. Again, textbook economics says, well, that should translate into massive inflation. There's none. So that it defies a textbook explanation. So I think there's one of the first points in making that observation is you have to interpret policy inside of the context, and that it doesn't just leap from the textbook charts into reality, that there is an environment and a circumstance and a set of conditions that will shape and influence and inform. So how is it that the US has been able to print money fiercely and yet the dollar has got stronger and stronger, notwithstanding the fact that they've done all of this printing? So I think that's one of the lessons of Japanification. The other is that it's to recognize that it goes beyond policy, and that policy resides on structure. And one of the structures that I would refer to, for instance, is the demography, that Japan has been fighting with one hand behind their back for a long time in terms of promoting industrialization, productivity, and competitiveness, because their population is aging. And that's a force that's going to come at you. And if you're going to change that with policy initiatives, it's going to take 20 years before those babies that are born today emerge into the workforce. But that then requires a whole re-engineering or a repositioning of the economy. It says, well, as a historically closed society, we're now going to open up. And that then brings in a different element or a different aspect of policy orientation. So I would venture that there is a much bigger story here than it's just, or they tried those policies and they didn't work. It's what's the context, against what backdrop, what are their circumstances, and what structure are those policies built on?
The one thing we are seeing that is comparable with Japan is loose monetary policy, rising debt to GDPs, and to Adrian's earlier point, we've seen the dollar be quite strong. Obviously, recently it's weakened a little bit, but the dollar's been strong in the face of ceaseless money printing. The inflation rates that the Fed has been targeting of 2% just doesn't seem to be achievable in this environment. They also have very low inflation. So there are similarities. Is the US becoming just a little Japanese?
I hope not. I hope they continue to play a much bigger role in the global economy, because there's been a retreat in the U.S., particularly around manufacturing, with the Trump strategy of bringing back manufacturing that had been outsourced to China and other countries to the U.S., to areas like Pittsburgh, Detroit, and many others. So I'm hoping that, you know, the U.S. realizes that it cannot live alone, despite its bigger size, being a larger economy than the Japanese, and being very much internally driven, that he has to play that bigger role in the global economy. And in doing so, look outside the U.S. and invest more, because I think they cannot look at themselves as a successful country alone. I think they need to rise above the petty politics that we've seen under the Trump administration to really look at a much larger role that we've seen with the U.S. as a beacon of capitalism, as a beacon of an open and democratic regime. And that role that it's now deferred has made it look more inwardly. And I think that's the Japanification that we'll see if they continue that strategy. I'll urge the U.S. to think really much bigger and revert to that global order that's played so critically in expanding the capitalism to the rest of the world.
It was interesting reading what Roger Stone, Trump's key campaign advisor, was advising him to do should he lose the election, declaring a state of martial law. We're talking about the U.S. here, not some tin pot dictatorship. Coming back to Japanification, Dave, what are the lessons, what are the policy implications in all of this for the developed world, before we talk about what we should be worried about here in the developing world?
Well, I think the first thing you need to decide for yourself is whether Japan is an outlier, as Adrian was saying, you get four different kinds of economies, or whether Japan is a leading indicator of what's happening in the rest of the world. And I think if I look at the behavior of markets, if you look at where interest rates are, if you look at what central banks are doing, if you look at what governments are doing in terms of pushing up their deficits, etc., I would regard Japan as a leading indicator of what's happening in the rest of the world, certainly the developed world. We know if you look at the whole debate about immigration, look at where the U.S. stands, that's played a major role in, you know, aging the Japanese population way too early. If we look at Europe, you know, over the last couple, 3, 4, 5 years, the whole issue of immigration has become central in politics, and there was a whole, you know, wave against that. And as I said, if you look at what central banks have been doing, I remember way back in the 1990s, people used to say the easiest trade in financial markets would be just to short Japanese bonds at 2% and go to the beach and come back as a rich person. Well, that's happened all over the world now. We saw interest rates, long-term interest rates at 2%. Yeah, it wasn't too long ago, but look at where interest rates are now. So we're following a clear trend, I think, that we should learn from Japan and not regard it as an outlier in terms of how we address economic policy and monetary policy in particular. And therefore, what the Fed has been doing now, I think, is slowly but surely moving in that direction with fate. You know, the flexible inflation or average inflation targeting that they're doing. But the important part of that is also delinking inflationary prospects from the state of the labor market. I don't think people realize how important that change has been in the monetary policy framework of the United States.
They've given up the so-called Phillips curve, the idea that low unemployment leads to higher inflation. Adrian, is the U.S. tempting fate? And I'm going to take you up on that point because you seem to think that Japan is an outsider.
Well, you know, I'm not saying that there is some immunity that, you know, because Japan has gone that way, you know, you can do the same things and you'll go in a different direction. The point that I'm making is those policies need to be interpreted inside of context. And in the case of Japan, one of the reasons why growth disappeared is productivity evaporated. And so, you know, they were throwing more and more capital at an ever-shrinking workforce just to stand still. Now, you know, the U.S. still has productivity working in its favor. In parts of Europe, you've got strong productivity gains, and those would support growth with shrinking populations. In the same breath, as both Lumkile and Dave and you have pointed out, there are unmistakable parallels, including the rising indebtedness, the ever-falling interest rates, the evaporation of inflation. And to Dave's point, if this is a marker of things to come or a signaler of things to come, then there's potentially very important investment messages in here, because the 1990s, from my earlier observation, was when, you know, the icons of investment portfolios were Sony and Yamaha and Toyota, and you could think of American companies that fit that bill today. And Japanese assets were very loved on extremely elevated multiples. And in 1990, the Nikkei peaked at 40,000 points. It's at 20,000 points today. It's 50% below its peak 30 years on. There are important things to be taken from the Japanese experience.
Fascinating. Just to bring it back home ahead of our Saab meeting, and obviously there's a lot of debate around the South African Reserve Bank that is really just noise, and that's around the nationalization of the Reserve Bank. I think we should be having a far more targeted conversation around monetary policy in South Africa and its role. Yes, Lumkile, there are structural issues that the governor has been at pains to belabor, that monetary policy cannot assist with. Monetary policy can't get the government to implement reforms, but it can reduce the cost of capital. And for businesses out there, the cost of capital is a critical component of the broader macro in South Africa. We don't have this issue around Japanification. What do you see the Reserve Bank doing this week? How do you see that policy debate going inside an environment where we saw a 50% quarterly decline in GDP? Inflation does seem to be anchored below the midway point of 4.5%, and we desperately need some form of stimulus.
I see them cutting tomorrow by 25 basis points just to try and play their role in an environment where we need to create demand. Therefore, a demand in both ways, where private sector can have access to cheaper capital and invest, but at the same time, the employees who will have jobs in the investment could then buy goods and services. So I see that coming, but I think the reality of South Africa is that on the fiscal space, we know that the returns on investment are very, very poor, because the state is incapable. Secondly, we have very poor leadership in taking the hard decisions that are required to implement those reforms, including the ICT space, including the ownership of critical infrastructure by the state, such as energy. So the really social reforms that are required lie on the hands of the state, which is incapable. So I think South Africa may in fact do what the Japanese have gone through, where we've got high deficit, we've got low growth, high unemployment, and all the pathologies that accompany that crisis because of the lack of leadership and taking those hard decisions.
And but probably a difference in the inflation profile, in that we still have inflation rising at multiples because of administered prices in particular. So stagflation certainly springs to mind. Dave, how do you see the Saab deliberating, and which way do you think it'll go this week?
I think there are two things that we need to look at. The one is the whole question of growth, and as Lukemia has pointed out, I think that, you know, he's absolutely spot on in terms of the problems there. But the second thing that's important for me is also, if you look at inflation in South Africa, I mean, I think inflation rate is a lot lower than people expect, because despite those massive increases that we've seen in, you know, administered prices, inflation has in fact behaved quite nicely. So if you look at it outside of that, I think there's a clear trend that in the private sector, the inflation rate is falling, and it's falling fast. So the Reserve Bank, I think, has to realize at some point that it, if you look at their expectations of inflation, it's been too high. And I think they need to look at that very seriously. And for me, that would need to imply that maybe they should lower interest rates.
So that's two for a cut. Adrian, you've got 10 seconds as we've got to wrap up. Which way do you see it going?
Bloomberg consensus is 9-8 split. and the forward rates agreements have got a 35% probability. So, boy, you know, you don't get much closer to 50-50. I'm going to go against the two and say that I think that the SARB is going to go into a holding pattern and leave a little bit of powder dry. But if they don't cut this week, they will cut at the next meeting.
I must say.
All said and done, very close to the bottom.
Yeah, squeaky bum time, I think a famous football manager once called it when it comes to the interest rate call this week. That was Dr. Adrian Saville, who is joined by Lumkile Mondi and Dave Moore of Old Mutual.